This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, joined as always by Bradley Chambers. And tonight we have two sponsors for the show. Our friends at both Jam Software and Aerohive Networks will tell you a little bit more, in fact a lot more, about both of those companies as the show goes on. Bradley, what's going on?
It's a good week. iPad week. I think I've made my decision. And so okay. I'm just anxiously waiting until Friday.
Oh, well, that tells me what your decision is.
Well, that's true, yeah, because there's no mini. What got me this morning was a student brought me their iPad to do something. And it was a full screen, and I turned it over and typed like a sentence on it, and I thought, I've missed this. Because it's harder to type on the mini, like landscape, like an actual keyboard. And so I think I'm going to go back to the iPad Air. I'm going to go with a 32-gigabyte black Wi-Fi only.
Okay. Well, that's a challenge because that's usually the most popular configuration. So you're going to have to get in line for that.
Well, I'll have to get in line anyways because the way it works in the U.S., like I'll have to order directly through Apple. And they are typically will ship to us slower than they will everybody else. Mm. Like if I was trying to get the Mini, I would not get it through the Apple Education Store until next year.
Really?
Because they always like they just like new products like that. They just all like the retail store may say like if it says like 1 week, the education store will say 2 to 3 weeks.
Right.
Yes. And it makes sense because they're trying to fulfill consumer demand. And what's funny too is like they stop shipping to schools here in the U.S. about mid-December because they know we go for Christmas break. And so like if you want something. If you need something, you have to. I've had to call and get them to actually ship it because they'll just hold it until like January because they obviously don't want a pallet full of MacBook Airs just sitting, around.
Yeah, it's going to be in a FedEx facility somewhere all Christmas.
They don't even ship it. Like typically, they've not even shipped it to. They won't even ship it to us. They'll just hold it. Like I couldn't even go pick it up. It'll just say I think it says held or something like that. But again, it makes sense. And that, of course, that goes. You and I both live in different worlds when it comes to buying through Apple because you typically go through a reseller. We don't even have that option. So like if I wanted to go buy an iPad at the local like Mac reseller, I cannot use my school tax exempt certificate or my school credit card. Like I have to pay for it personally and pay taxes because which I did in the past. I have just paid the taxes and been done with it. But it's nice to not pay tax. Saves on my budget.
Indeed. So yeah, I'm thinking the same. Did you say you were going for a black one or a white one?
Black one. I always do black. My wife always gets the white ones, and I always get the black ones. I'll tell you, the one of the things that really sold me on the black is my wife's iPad is white, and when my son eats Cheetos and watches Netflix, it's got a nice orange tint to it.
Yeah, there's always one substance that children get involved in that can just stain a white iPad. Let's not even discuss the state of children's iPads and how disgusting the screens are. I can see visions of streaks of grease over the.
I clean 80 iPads every Friday. It's the last thing I do every Friday, and they brought me two today that were like needed to be charged, and they were disgusting. And it was the iPads that our 3-year-old used, and I don't even want to know what I was touching. It makes me it just makes me sad.
So when there's lumps stuck to the front of the iPad, that's the worst.
Oh, that is every one of the 3-year-old iPads. There are clumps of something, and I'm just assuming it's dried food. I'm going to assume.
Yeah, just tell yourself that. Yep.
Yes.
That's why it's so important to get one of the cases that only holds the corners and clips, so that you've got a clear space halfway down the iPad to wipe all the crud off and just drop it on the floor.
Yes. So what model are you getting?
I'm going for iPad Air. I've pretty much decided that I'm a full-size iPad kind of guy. Since my experience in having used the iPad Air or the iPad Mini for a while, I reckon just, the width of my shoulders, the size of my hands, all of those things, I just want to have a full-size one because I want to do a lot in my iPad. So I'm going to go for at least 64 gig 3G. Or 4G in theory, but not 4G in actual practice, of course. Not yet, anyway, here. iPad Air. I'm toying with white, but... and the only reason I'm toying with white is because I kind of feel like iOS 7 is designed to be used in a white iOS device. But I sort of like black as well, so it's going to be a tough one. I might have to just make my decision on the spot in the store. May even just be down to which one they have.
Like, what if there is only a 16 gig and a 128 model? What do you buy?
A 16 and a 128?
Yeah.
Well, it'd have to be the 128. For sure. The 16 is just... No.
Yeah, that makes me sad. You know, I never get the three or the cellular models, mainly because I'm on Wi-Fi like 90% of the time. But now I have, we changed our AT&T plan here at the office, and I have tethering available. We have 10 gigs, you know, between us. And so I just feel like if I can, like, save the $129 and bump up to, like, the next storage, because I typically would have got, like, a 16 gig, but I'll just get the 32.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't absolutely need that, then the storage is always going to go to good use. I mean, I've found that the iOS tethering is just not good enough. You know, I find it a very frustrating thing because the phone will shut off the tethering to try and preserve battery life, I guess. And then when you want to turn it on again, you've got to dig into settings, and eventually get it in. So the reason I go for cellular iPads is because I don't want to have to sit there. I typically don't sit down with my iPad for a very long time and do something remotely. It's typically short bursts of things. I want to check this thing, I want to do that thing, or whatever. And I don't want to have to go through that setup process. Yeah. Whereas with my Mac, I don't mind it, because if I'm out with my Mac and I want to get on the internet, well, I'm sitting down at a coffee shop or something and I'm going to sit there for 30, 40 minutes. I can take 2 or 3 minutes to set up the tethering. Whereas with my iPad, I want to be able to just crack it open and do something with it straight away. But the reason that it kind of works better for me is because we can buy prepaid iPad SIM cards over here. So what I do is I use the 3 network, which is one of the networks over here. And their kind of business is focused on data usage rather than calls as such. But you can buy a SIM card, a prepaid SIM card from them for, I think it's £20, £21 I think it is. And that has 3 gigs of data transfer, valid for 3 months. And if you don't use it within the 3 months, you just lose it. But if you use it all up, you can just throw it away and buy another one. So that's what I've been doing, is I just go and buy them from the store for cash, basically, and use them, throw them away, and then replace them again. And that costs me £20 every so often, whereas any kind of contract plan, you're talking about £15 to £18 every single month, which I don't need that much. I don't need that much data, but I need it to be there most of the time. So that's how I feed my cellular iPad.
Yeah, I would be looking at paying $15 a month minimum. Of course, I was intrigued by T-Mobile's plans where they have you get 200 megs or 200 megs a month for the life of the device. And then you can also buy daily and weekly passes. And that might be intriguing, because if I, let's say, was going to be out of town and did want to buy a week pass, I just don't want to pay another $15 a month, because you just feel like that's every month it adds up. But no, if I could do it like yours, where I could just buy a bucket at a time, that would be nice. It'd be nice if it wouldn't expire. That would be even better.
Yeah, I can understand why they do that. I mean, they've got to make the money somehow, I guess. But you know, I kind of feel like 3 gigs is 3 gigs, and if I use it over the course of 1 month or 3 months, you know, what's the difference to you, really, you know, as the network provider? But, you know, it is what it is, and it's better now than it used to be. I mean, I used to be paying £15 a month for service, and now I'm just paying whenever I want to pay, which is great.
That's true. I guess before we get started on the topic today, let me stop and thank one of our sponsors today. It's Aerohive Networks back again this week. You guys know about Aerohive. We talked about them on many shows. They reduce the cost and complexity of building today's networks with cloud-managed products. They have Wi-Fi switches and branch routing solutions for enterprise, small businesses, schools, remote workers, really, really anybody can take advantage of Aerohive's products. They have an incredible cooperative control architecture for their products where there's no centralized single point of failure. They have centralized management with either a local or a hosted cloud managed option, so you can even run their cloud services in your own data center. Eliminate costly controllers and single points of failure, especially on your Wi-Fi networks, which are very crucial. Because, really for me today, wireless is my network. It's not an add-on. 95% of my users use wireless, so I've got to have a robust wireless network. And one of the cool things, this is especially as, teams get started for basketball and soccer and football, I guess, if you're overseas, when I say football, it's what I consider to be soccer. And, you can use their branch router. So it's like a little wireless router. The BR200WP is the one I'd recommend. And you can actually plug in a 4G LTE card into it. And so, if you have students that are going on long athletic trips, maybe going overnight, maybe going for a 3 or 4 hour bus ride away, you can provide Wi-Fi in the bus, and so they can actually catch up on their homework and not just get behind in the classroom. So that's a very valid use case. I know my AeroHive SE does that in the car. He basically travels with a Wi-Fi hotspot between the AeroHive's branch router and a 4G card. One of the cool things you could do with that is you could enforce that they can't do Facebook and Twitter on the bus. You could apply a policy that only blocks all social networking, all games, all that. So very easy to do with AeroHive's products. You can learn more about them at AeroHive.com or follow them on Twitter. It's at AeroHive. And if you're in the market for a new wireless network, they have webinars every week where you can get a free access point with their cloud management service. So thanks for AeroHive Networks for sponsoring the show today. It's AeroHive.com. It's AeroHive.com. And there will be a link in the show notes as well.
Nice. I think I'm going to go on one of those webinars under a false name and get one for my house.
Well, yeah. It's funny, I've got an AeroHive network at the house, and to kind of see how much we use typically with Netflix, because we don't have cable. So everything we do is Netflix. And it's I think one week I use 25 gigs of internet. It was quite crazy because you can you can even see what device and what service you're using. It's kind of scary how much we use the internet. Of course, thankfully we don't have an ISP. I don't have an ISP that has data caps. And so, I can use 100 megs a month or, whatever. But
yeah, it's nice to have that. We have that here too. I actually did a speed test on my phone this morning for reasons unrelated. And my home broadband bizarrely clocked in at 80 megabits per second this morning.
Wow.
I thought I had 50. And for some reason, it seems to have been bumped up. So happy days on that, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was surprised I could even see those numbers on the phone. I wasn't sure if Wi-Fi might not. I mean, I've got an Airport Extreme base station at home. One of the newest models, not the newest model, the kind of vertical one, but the last of the flat models. I wasn't sure if that would actually eventually become the bottleneck or not. But
it is because, your phone's data rate tops out at 150. Mm-hmm. But, that's your data rate. I've not seen my iPhone get above 100. I think that the most I've seen it on a speed test is 80 or 90. Again, data rate and actual throughput on wireless are two drastically different things. So even when I've done my early 802.11 AC wave one testing, I'm seeing throughput of, I think I saw 600 meg transfer, something like that, and then but the data rate was close to 900, so you're just which is not really, I really wish the marketing would be about the throughput, but I understand why the data rate, because the throughput's harder to measure and to control. Mm-hmm. Where the data rate, if I did a data rate right now on my Mac, it would be 144 megabits per second, but I would not get that on actual throughput. But
yeah
marketing cool. Versus tech. So
it's always good. So tonight's topic, as promised last week, a little bit more on the iLife and iWork transition from Apple from last week. How have you found it so far?
Knowing what, I guess I'll preface this by saying my life isn't built around iWork and iLife. I use them, but it's not, I don't have these ingrained workflows where I've got to print name badges out of Pages every single week. And if something changes on Pages, I have to rebuild them. Yeah. I go into Pages. I think the only pages document I have that I even like would open regularly is my resume. I usually make it a habit, just update it once a quarter. Just, you know, I read that in a book somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see that if your workflows were completely built around it, where it is difficult. But I think knowing that going in, knowing it had changed, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised by the changes they made.
Yeah, I guess I feel much the same way. I mean, the one part of the whole suite that I completely depend on is Keynote, because I use it professionally, not every day in the classroom, but certainly when I'm consulting and presenting elsewhere. Keynote, and in particular for the last year, I think Keynote and iOS has really been kind of my mainstay presentation tool. And I have a lot of fairly substantial decks in there. But even with the sort of richness and complexity of some of those Keynote decks, I did not find very many issues with what features had been taken out of Keynote. I had used maybe one or two of them occasionally, but for the most part, it has been a fairly smooth upgrade for me too. So I think what I'm feeling, the sense I get on the internet is that people who used the features that are not there are furious, and the people who didn't use the features that are not there are pretty happy. And that seems to be roughly where we're at. Although I think that people, everybody who has used iLife, you know, over the past few years, I think everybody's been made a little bit nervous about this. And I think in some ways it could have been handled a little bit better, even if they did the same thing in the end, you know, because instead of saying, oh, here's all new Keynote and all new iLife and iWork, it's unified and it's great. But in fact, if they had taken maybe a little more time just to explain the thinking behind it, like we said last week, in the way that they eventually had to do for Final Cut Pro 10 after the outcry about some of the things that were removed from that, I think people could have been left feeling a lot more confident than they are right now. You know, I'm seeing comments all over Twitter and the web saying things like, well, who can depend on Apple now, kind of thing. And that's something to be concerned about from a reputation point of view, rather than that there's an actual problem with the usability of these programs. I think people can be very dramatic about these things. And I, having built a couple of decks in Keynote 2 or Keynote 13 for Mac, and then used them today on my iPad in school, I was pretty happy with that it was a fully faithful rendition of the file on both sides. So happy with that.
Yeah, I think that the unification of the file format, if that was the only feature, that's a huge feature, because it was very confusing to me. I don't use, didn't use iWork a ton on my iPad, but it was mainly because when I would get some message about like things not working and to make a copy, and I didn't know what to do with that. And
yeah,
and I, you know, and so the fact that they can be truly seamless, you've got to think like Apple's building these products for the next generation of Apple customers, not necessarily the people that are relying on Numbers today, but like the people that are going to start using Numbers tomorrow. And so they're trying to make those hard decisions of like, we've got to, and from a technical perspective, it's not easy. We've got to unify this file format, and we'll have some links in the show notes on the details of the format, like some of the technical things. And it's not trivial. It's not like clicking a button in Xcode, and it looks like they had to do a lot of heavy lifting. And mm-hmm. It seems like it was all built around making it easier for iCloud, to where it didn't have to upload. Like if you've got a Keynote document that's 50 megs, every time you save it, it doesn't have to save the entire 50 megs over again.
Yeah, I think I find that iCloud does a good job with that already, because I have some decks that are like 500 to 600 megabytes, and I can quite easily make a small textual edit on the iPhone and have that change reflected on the other platforms quite quickly, much more quickly than it would be if it was the full freight going up the channel. But I think the hardest part for me with the previous situation was that it was really hard to know what it was you did. And the way it was described, like what it was you did in order to cause it to become again incompatible with the iOS version. And I think in some ways it was often just, well, you opened this on the Mac, therefore we're going to be really conservative and tell you that there might be a problem. But even, this is one of the most sort of maddening things about working between iOS and the Mac in the previous version, was that even the templates were not the same on both sides, even when they were named the same thing. So the gradient template, for example, on the Mac used one font, and on iOS used a different font. Things like that were just sort of maddening. And it's nice that all of that's been unified now. And hopefully, you know, that's the hardest part of the work out of the way. And we can move forward on the basis of that.
You know, I kind of look at this, I don't know, like, if you've ever planted roses, but like we at our last house, we had like our side of driveway, we had 5 rose bushes. And so I looked at the Mac, like it's the one you planted, you know, that I planted in 2007. And I came along and planted one in 2009 and 2011. You know, you're supposed to trim rose bushes back every year. It helps them to grow and grow stronger. And so I look at the Mac, like we had to trim it up quite a bit to make it more uniform with the 2 smaller ones, the 2 younger ones. And so as they grow together and they grow more seamlessly. And I look at, we basically had to trim back the Mac version. Yeah, we've lost a few features. Some of them are in different places, but long term for the, you know, going forward with iWork, this should drastically speed up development because we've unified the file format. I would like to think they've unified the code base. I have no idea if they have, but I'd like to think they've unified the code base. And so going forward, we're kind of playing on the level playing field, and we're not having to have multiple teams working on these products, that we can, you know, basically move forward as a with the product line. That the Mac and the iOS versions of iWork and iLife are, you know, specifically iWork are the same. So that's, you know, my analogy for the day.
Yeah, no, I think the other thing about it is that, you know, where are the next million iWork customers coming from? Right? I want to say they're coming from iOS, and they may eventually come to the Mac. They may never come to the Mac, but it seems to me that this transition has been designed to favor people who came from iOS and are coming onto the Mac. Because from looking at some of the documents that kids have done in school and some of the documents I've done where I started on iOS, those seem to be direct upgrades to the new file format. So the speculation, I think, is that it's basically the iOS file format ported back to the Mac. And it seems to me that those people are in for a much smoother transition than people who have a lot of iWork 09 documents on the Mac trying to transition into iWork 13. It seems to me that they're not having a terrible time of it, but I think it seems also that Pages is much worse affected than Keynote is. So I don't have too much experience of that, but I think it's it seems obvious to me that this is like iWork for the iOS generation. And you can take that in one of two ways. I mean, you can take that as a negative comment. You can see it's iWork, you know, the old timers will say it's iWork for the dumbed down generation who are just playing with toys. Or you could say it's iWork for a new generation of users doing different kinds of things with it. And I kind of feel like it's almost a bit of a generational attitude change depending on which side of that line you fall on, whether you're don't get me wrong, people have got a lot of work invested in these files and workflows. It's not like that's something that should be broken lightly. But it's not obvious to me that it has been broken lightly. It seems to be a change for the future rather than just maintaining the past.
Because if you don't, then this is how you end up like Microsoft Office, which, I mean, if you really think about it, the fact that Microsoft has just basically packed on with Office has, A, allowed iWork to exist. And be, I mean, you got to think, if Microsoft Office was able to, you know, create something like iWork, then iWork would not have existed, possibly. But you look at the challenges that Microsoft has had in bringing Office to iOS and other platforms. It's because it was always built for the desktop. And so it's been a hard transition to mobile. And you know, when I say mobile, I mean, I include tablets. So they've had a hard time to rethink Office for the next generation. Even look at the Surface. To me, what I've seen, it just looks like the desktop. They've not been able to say, all right, we're cutting it back, we're starting over, and we're going to build it up for the next generation. And why can't they? Because the enterprise would kill them. I mean, when I moved people from Office 2003 to 2007, people had a conniption fit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's work to be done. And I think you're right. It's absolutely I was going to say it's debatable. It's not even debatable. It's a fact that Office has not made the transition to touch. It's as simple as that. And whether or not they're running on a touchscreen, they are not a touch-based product. And I think that is not really something that can be debated. Question is whether they can. Who knows? But I think it's, you know, maybe even Microsoft is looking at Surface going, are we going to get enough users to justify the cost of making that transition on Windows RT, certainly, and possibly on Surface at all?
Well, I you know, Steve Jobs always kind of was famous for saying we're going to bet the company on this. And I think that's the conundrum that Microsoft is in, because they make so much money from Office. Do they have like a skunkworks project and tell a team, you know, tell a manager and tell them to go build a team, him or her a team, and say, build us the next generation of productivity software. This isn't the Office team. This is the Microsoft productivity team. And go build the next generation of whatever, whether it be a word processor, whether it be a spreadsheet, whether it be, you know, just what, go build something that basically build Microsoft's iWork and build it, you know, from touch from the ground up and have it work, you know, seamlessly across all things over SkyDrive or whatever it's called now. And that's what I'm afraid they've not been able to do. But it's much more difficult for them to do these kind of transitions than Apple's, because, you know, Apple, I mean, how many people are building their entire company's workflow over iWork? I mean, we're not, you know, from a, like our you know, our church side, for example, we're, I mean, it's not, it's, you know, we have some people that are doing things, but like our accountants are using Excel. And so it's, they have different challenges, but
yeah, I mean, I think also you can say, well, can we even define productivity for the 21st century? I mean, what does that mean? And why isn't email part of that, right? You know, okay, you've got Outlook and things like that, but it kind of, you know, is your Twitter client part of your productivity toolset? Possibly it is. You know, and I know that on many platforms, like my video conferencing tools and my email tools and my SMS messages, for example, or iMessage, is absolutely a productivity tool for me. And is Facebook a productivity tool? Maybe for some people. Evernote, you know, there's so many. It just feels to me like there's a definition of productivity, which is typing things into a word processor and possibly making a presentation or doing a spreadsheet. And that feels to me like a very 1990s definition of productivity. It's not a holistic view at all of the way that people actually get their jobs done today. And it feels to me like to take one or two specific tasks and call them the sort of golden productivity tasks that we do on computers versus a very holistic view of all the apps that you might want to use together. I kind of feel like that is quite old-fashioned now. And in school, we have an issue with that as well when we talk about what is the IT curriculum and what's the computing curriculum. I mean, I'm teaching this course called Administration and IT this year, which has literally just been written. And one module in that course is word processor, spreadsheet, presentation. Right? And it's kind of like, well, there's the bit that's Microsoft Office, right? And then, okay, there's a bit after that that might be the web or something, I'm not sure. But I just feel like the world's moved past that.
Yeah, you're right. We've moved past the mindset. Not necessarily the mindset, but we've moved past the need for Office to get work done, because the majority of things I do in Office are having to open documents that people send me. Office does not live on my dock.
Yeah.
And of course, neither does iWork. I mean, my two most important tools to my quote unquote productivity are Wunderlist and Evernote.
Yeah. Yeah. And who knows? I mean, it's not to say there's not a massive legacy base of people who have Office documents that they want to use. I mean, I'm not saying that there's a, you know, everybody's going to rewrite those documents in iWork or you know, as Google Docs or whatever. But I think the world moves on, and it moves on more quickly than a lot of people think. So it remains to be seen. I mean, like you said, Microsoft has, there is an existence proof of the fact that you don't need Office, and it's called iOS and Android. And the fact that there's hundreds of millions of these devices in the field, none of which have ever run Office, and people are using them perfectly happily for entertainment, productivity, communication, creativity, and in most cases, there's not a single Microsoft product on any of them. Okay, there's OneNote for iOS, but only in the US? I mean, what's up with that as well? I can't even install that in the UK, as far as I know. That certainly was true at one time. It may still be true. So, you know, the world's going mobile, and what's the most popular mobile productivity suite?
Yeah. No, you're right.
It's certainly not Office. And I suggest it probably is iWork. And the Google Docs experience is good on the desktop. It's not so great in mobile, but it is there, you know, so it's at least number two, right? And Office is like number zero because it's not there, you know. So time will tell.
You know what's interesting about Office, and of course it's on the iPhone, but, you know, if you're not in a place you've ever managed kind of an Exchange, you know, domain controller environment, you know, I'll give you my last job, for example. Like when I was there, they had a local Exchange server and they had a domain controller. Assuming they are still running that setup, and I think they are, they cannot even use Office on the iPhone because it requires a 365 account. So if you have all these legacy Microsoft servers and, you know, even not even legacy, like if you have a...
If you have the current version.
Yeah, yeah, you have the current version, but you just don't subscribe to their cloud services, like there's no way to even... To even use that, and without, you know, by having to buy a separate subscription for each employee, and you know, my thoughts there is Microsoft should be letting companies build their own iCloud type service, their own SkyDrive type service, where you know you can install Office, they can log in with their credentials, it pings your server, and all their documents are there. I mean, that's what Microsoft should be building. They should be focused on like you know those kind of those Fortune 500 companies that. You know, yeah, let them buy their iPads, but then let them install Office and get all of their documents off the server, off the you know, quote unquote shared drive. Like yeah. That's Microsoft. I mean, the fact that Microsoft can't even do that blows my mind.
Yeah, it feels just like missing the boat in so many different ways. And I mean, what's the deal with it only being on the iPhone? Why on earth is that not on the iPad? Well, we know why not, right? Because they want to run adverts to say the Surface is the only tablet with Office on it. But, you know, seriously, who's got a Surface? You know, it's... I think one of the things that I wanted to point out about iWork by comparison is that whereas Google Docs and Office 365, the productivity suite is part of a larger ecosystem of subscription services, whether for money in the case of Microsoft or free in the case of Google in many cases. That's very different to iWork, where iWork is enhanced by iCloud, but it's absolutely not required to get you know the most out of your particular instance of iWork. And I think that's an interesting distinction because, you know, I mean, a consumer can always sign up for a Google account and use Docs. And yeah, of course that works. But in the school scenario, Google Docs works for us, at least in the with the teachers, because we have our system in place. But we also use iWork, and the kids all use iWork. They don't use Google Docs on the iPad. It's just not quite good enough there yet, as well. So, it's interesting times, and I think Apple may have looked at where Microsoft is with Office and started to worry a little bit. You know, unless we do something to really rework iWork, are we going to end up in the same situation as Office where we somehow, for some reason, can't port it? So it's been a brave step. It's not a terribly surprising step because, you know, we've seen it happen with iMovie. We've seen it happen with Final Cut Pro 10. I mean, that was a very bold step to take a pro-level thing that movie studios are built on, or at least editing houses are built on, and take things away from them. I mean, Final Cut Pro was like the Microsoft Word of the film industry in large part. And Apple just went ahead and said, look, we're going to fix this. We're going to make it work better for the future. There's going to be some short-term pain. That's fine. But the difference, like I said before, is when They did that with iMovie and then with Final Cut Pro. They sort of came out and said, yeah, we know we're not done yet. Sit tight and things will come. And things, crucially, with Final Cut Pro, things did quickly come thereafter. So the multi-camera support and different things that had to come back to Final Cut Pro, they did come back. Whereas with iWork, there's kind of been a, well, here's this great new version with a unified file format. I hope you enjoy it. Off you go. And it would be really good for Apple to come out and say, okay, we've heard you. This is where we're going with this. And critically, ship a few updates pretty quick that bring some things back. Now, I don't think that everything has to be brought back. I think there are some things that have been taken out of Keynote, for example, and out of Pages that uncrustify it, and things that, in broad measure, people didn't even know was there. You know, things like smart builds in Keynote, which I think, not to put too fine a point on, were probably built just because Steve Jobs wanted to do a particular slide in a particular presentation. I think there's also a change, particularly with Keynote, because that's the one I think about a lot. There's also a change to the way people want to present now. And it feels to me like people are getting simpler, but they're also building bigger slide decks. And I think the inclusion of video, it's not new that video is in Keynote, but it feels to me like that's something that's going to be a bigger deal. Is if you look at the new templates as well, they've all got big master slides with a lot of photo space and not a lot of text around them. And those have been really tweaked beyond what looked like, you know, albeit much nicer designed versions of PowerPoint templates in the first place. The new templates that come with Keynote are really of a kind of newer style of presenting than the ones that came before. And I think that's interesting as well, just as a little kind of indicator to where things might be going.
Well, you know, it was interesting on that note. I was listening to episode 99 of The Critical Path, which deals largely around, you know, iWork and the kind of their ramifications from a financial standpoint. And Horace Dedue, who is apparently a huge numbers user, of course, really loves the new version. And he talks through it, and so we'll have a link in the show notes to the episode, so if you're interested, go listen to it. But he even talks that he doesn't use Keynote. You know, he famously uses the Perspectives app to do presentations, mm-hmm. and I think that lends along with what you're saying, that people are presenting things differently. We've all heard the death by PowerPoint jokes, and people's presentation skills are evolving.
They are, for sure. And I was talking about this on Twitter a little bit this week, that I have consciously been doing less on my PowerPoint slides or my Keynote slides because I can't decide whether to be upset about this or not, but I just note for the record that it is a thing that is happening, is that when I present, what happens is that a third of the audience are on their smartphones doing something else, a third are paying a lot of attention, and a third are just sitting there taking a photograph of every slide that goes up. And I'm not necessarily caring about that from like an intellectual property point of view or something like that, but I'm just kind of like, would you put your phone down and just listen to what I'm saying, you know? I don't know what these people do with these pictures when they go home. Do they reconstruct them into, you know, really poor copies of my Keynote deck? I'm not sure, but I want to move away from those images on the screen being the show and moved more towards me, my presentation being the show, and have those be supporting. So I've been working on sort of slowly rebuilding my main Keynote decks in the new version of Keynote, and very consciously doing it with many, many more bigger images and much less text in the slides. And I think that's something that's coming along.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, just as if you read the book, I think it was How to Present Like Steve Jobs. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. And it talks about, you know, you should be able to present without your slides. Like if you're reliant along your slides to be able to get your point across, then you're really kind of missing the boat. Like you should be able to just walk up there and talk and people should understand. And So let's take a moment for our last sponsor, Jamp Software. We've talked about them for many weeks now. You guys know them. They provide your IT staff with enterprise tools that allow you to kind of wrangle Apple products in your organization. So it's Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs now. One of their great pieces of software they have is Casper Focused. What this is it allows the teacher, not the IT staff, but the teacher to basically quickly gain students' attention. So, like, if they've got an iPad, they can take control of the iPad, move it to, a certain app. Again, very easy for the teacher. It's not even something the IT staff has to do. So a couple of other things it can do, you can conduct secure exams. You can even select a specific Apple TVs. You can choose and distribute iBooks. And you can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. So it's really, really great tool. So if you manage Apple products in your organization, Jamp software is the one you want to look at for your mobile device management. And I'm really not even really just mobile device, but just device management. Jampsoftware.com is their website. They have a really great Twitter account. It's at Jamp Software. I think they've even got a good promotion I saw about earlier today. So Jampsoftware.com. Check out more about them. Thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show.
Mm-hmm. Still haven't put my Apple TVs under NDM control yet.
Well,
one day I'll get that done.
I tell you, one of the nice things that Apple did in the most recent update is they now have automatic software update as an option for Apple TV, which is very nice. It's like, I mean, even like as a complete first world problem at my house, some Apple TVs just don't get used as often as others. So I would just never update them because it would take 3 hours. And so we would actually be sitting down to use that Apple TV. And it's like kind of the running joke inside our house that like when I go to update the Apple TVs, it just takes forever and we never get to watch what you want to watch. So yeah. So now it's got auto update. Yep. I really hate like the screensavers on the Apple TV. So what I did is like I made a Flickr set of like what I wanted to be my screensaver because I wanted something that didn't require a computer to be on. But the downside of the way the Apple TV screensaver works is you can't like log into your Flickr account and see private photos. So I couldn't I didn't really know how to do pictures of my kids or whatever. So I have all these like cool backgrounds and it's just like in a public set and that's my screensaver.
Awesome.
So,
Apple TV.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got four of them now.
Four.
Yeah. I keep hoping for like a new one. It's, I don't know. Of course, they're all the latest generation. I had one of the original black ones, but it turns out those are a really hot commodity on eBay because they can be hacked. So I sold the first gen one for like $150 and then turned around and bought a second gen for $100.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's like the 720p only model or something like that.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got two 720p's in school and the rest are 1080s. But I don't know which is which.
Because there is no way to know. Yeah, it's true.
No. I think you can maybe, if I did have them under MDM, I could probably extract their model number or something and figure it out that way. But I can't remember which is which at all anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah, kind of circling back around, you're talking about Google Drive and Office 365. Like, I just wonder, does Apple need to address the email portion of all of this? Like, because that's one of the hooks with, when we switched to Google Apps years ago, that was like one of the hooks that I used is like Google Drive or Google Docs at the time. And does Apple need to have an iCloud for schools? Like where that's the backbone of everything, where it could manage your, it could be Apple ID, it could be email, it could be iCloud account, where it could for collaboration. Like, do you think Apple should? A, and B, do you think they ever will?
I'm going to say yes and no on that. I think Apple's very, very focused on serving the individual consumer, and I think almost pathologically focused on that, to the point, I mean, John Siracusa has complained about this many, many times, where almost everything is an island, so the iWork and the iLife and the iPhoto that's on my computer is completely distinct from the iPhoto that's next door in my wife's computer, and there's no service whatsoever that will combine them in any way. And I know, Bradley, you've written about ways to work around that with different services. So I think, if you could imagine a dashboard for iCloud where I could provision multiple other iCloud accounts and I could map my email domain to Apple rather than to Google servers, then use my domain as the email address and set up all that stuff together, that would be pretty cool. Question is iCloud email reliable enough? I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah, that, you would need it to be very, very reliable. Google has been rock solid for us over the past, 3.5 years, we've been on them. And once you went, you'd be all in on Apple, and it'd be a challenge. But if it, if they pulled it off, it could be pretty magical. You know, if you used, you know, Macs and iPads in your school and all that, and just kind of like one single login, no Google involved, and it just worked, that could be a really nice experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, now it's, I mean, if you talk about wanting to use the iCloud collaboration, I mean, do you have to have, like, let's say a student was going to share a Pages document with me. You know, do, like, if they share it to my work email address, but that's not what I typically use for iCloud, like, would that even show up in, like, Pages on the iPad?
Yeah. Well, I haven't tried it yet, but I don't understand, and I didn't understand from the demo what problem that was supposed to solve, because as far as I can tell, the collaboration stuff can only be done through browsers. It can't be done through any of the native clients. That part seems to be clear now. It kind of feels to me a wee bit like, okay, that's a foundation for, in the future, being able to collaborate right in the native clients. And it's possible. It seems, if not actually likely, it seems possible to me that they could, having solved the server-side part of it, they could bring that to the clients in a future update. And that would be cool. And that, if that worked, that to me would be very interesting in terms of comparing that with a Google Docs experience, which, okay, it works on the, it works very well in the browser, but doesn't work that well on the client, on the iOS, the mobile client. So I guess wait and see on that. You know, we've seen a big disruptive change, and you know, when a fire is started, it clears away space for other things to grow. And I think my hope would be, and I suppose my expectation to a certain extent would be, that we will see more advanced features in the clients on the back of this change. But they're not all there yet.
Yeah, I guess it's important to look at this as like a foundational change for the future. I think so. You know, you have to, and again, go back, this is what Microsoft's been unable to do. This is like, this may be dramatic, but this is like the OS X transition. And we know it's going to be, you know, we know it's going to be painful up front, but this is better for the long-term viability of the Mac. And so, yeah, this may be painful up front for iWork, but by doing this, it allows us to go faster, further. Or further, yeah. Faster, I guess is the correct saying.
One or other of those two.
You know, it's like a reboot. A reboot versus instead of a regression, is I guess how I would look at it. But no, you're right, and we shouldn't be mm-hmm. surprised. And we've been through this with iMovie. Final Cut did this. But, I look at, you kind of can look at this two ways. Like, is this a simplify and then add features back? Or is this a simplify for the future? You know, this is we're trimming it down and making it easier for everybody rather than like we're creating a new base. And I would largely think it's going to be like Final Cut, where it's simplify and then add features back and allow us to do more.
Yeah, I think it's potentially both, right? I think there's some features that are gone that will never come back, and probably rightly so. But at the same time, there's features that are gone that will come back in a much better form in the future, one trusts. And I guess maybe to kind of wrap it up a little bit, if I'm disappointed in anything, what I'm disappointed in is the fact that the iOS apps don't seem to have many more new capabilities. That, to me, is the biggest disappointment in this whole transition. Not the loss of a few esoteric features in the Mac versions, but the fact that I can't do very much more with Keynote and iOS today than I could last week or the week before. I can do a couple of things, very, very small range of things that are new in terms of like self-playing presentations and links only and so on, which are clearly kiosk orientated, like we said last week. But the fact that, for example, I still can't choose the in and out points of a video, and I still can't control the playback of a video during the presentation on iOS, those kind of things to me are a disappointment. I had hoped for a bit more on that. And if I have a personal criticism of it, it's that the iOS apps haven't gotten better enough in this release. That's not to decry the fact that, you know, turning them into iOS 7 versions is not a lot of work, because it absolutely is. But I kind of had hoped for more actual functionality improvements. But we live in hope for the future, I suppose.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay, so anything else to report? I guess next week we'll maybe have a chat about will we have our new iPads by next week?
I doubt hopefully. I will.
You might not. Yeah, you might have to wait a little bit. I am hoping to get one either Friday or Saturday. I'm not certain. But it depends how nice the people at the Apple Store are going to be to me. We'll see. Trying to schmooze a little bit and see what I can get done. But like I said last week, the nice thing about buying one of the fancy iPads, the one the high-end ones, is that nobody wants one. Nobody wants to spend that kind of money, so there's usually one in stock. So fingers crossed, I might have to settle for a white one. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe about Christmas I'll have mine. Maybe. We'll see. We'll see. My hope is to get it by the end of the next week, but we shall see.
Okay. Well, we'll have a chat about it then. I'll let you know if I manage to get one, how it goes.
And if anybody's listening and wants to learn more about iWork, I've got a couple links in the show notes that we really didn't even discuss that much, but that are kind of good reads just about the future of iWork and on the new file format. So be a good read for you.
Definitely. Good stuff. Well, right. Let's wrap it up there. Bradley, why don't you pimp your book as well? You haven't mentioned that in a while, but I think with our discussion of iLife, it's probably worth a mention.
Yeah, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll know I wrote a book called Learning to Love Photo Management. It's a short 20-page, more of an instruction manual than a book, but it's a guide for kind of wrangling your photos across all of your devices between Mac and iOS specifically. Really, really inexpensive. It's $3 or $2.99. You can get it off my website at chambersdaily.com, on the Kindle store, or on the iBook store, but it's iPad only or for the Mac. It doesn't work on the iPhone. So if you want to read it on the iPhone, either buy the PDF from my website or buy it from the Kindle store. So $2.99.
Absolutely. I've been trying to set that up this week, but I sort of did it wrong the first time, so I'm going to try and redo it over the weekend. But yeah, good times.
Yes, well, photos make me sad, and I was hoping my book would be Sherlocked by iOS 7, but it was not.
Fingers crossed for iOS 8.
Yeah, I would like for my book to be Sherlocked because it's funny, I get tired of like answering the questions about photos from our staff members. Yeah. So I just gave them a copy of the book and direct them to certain chapters, and they don't want to read them. I told the teacher yesterday or the other day, I said, look, it's 2 pages, you read chapter 2. The question was like about something about importing. I said, it's 2 pages with pictures, read chapter 2. And it's easier for me to give copies away.
Ain't nobody hates learning like a teacher, eh?
Exactly. Especially a 20-page book. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Okay. Let's leave it there for this week, and we'll catch up again next week, hopefully with new iPads in hand.
Yes. Have a good week, everybody.